I'm testing.
That's good. Just go ahead.
Well, good morning, everyone. Near and far and farther. It's so great that through the wonders of Zoom, we can more than fill this zendo, more than we otherwise could. Just like Vimalakirti. All those couple of thousand years ago who did it, who managed to have countless more people in his little room with only the technology of the mind and the imagination. So let's use ours to include, you know, the vast Sangha that is always here with us in our hearts. You know, those who would like to be here maybe today, who can't. I can think of several, more than several. And the trees and the forests, the rivers, and all the beings that live in the sea, and all the people who are struggling in the hurricane out in the Maritimes, where Michael and I just were. We're just thinking of the folks we just saw, and all the other folks around the world who are struggling with floods and fires and the consequences of the climate crisis, which are of course all interwoven with social and political instability and war and all that arising from our human greed, hatred, and ignorance. You know, which is a pretty big, can feel pretty heavy awareness to hold. And that's why I think we kind of felt that this old text, this Vimalakirti text, has some skillful means to offer us in living in a world where there's so much suffering. How could he have ever imagined this world we live in now? Beyond imagination, really. So I want to emphasize a couple of points for those who weren't here yesterday. We'll try and get Michael's talk from yesterday up on online tonight if you wanna catch that. His introduction to the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is our theme for practice period, the sutra and who Vimalakirti was. But just two points I want to review are that, one, Vimalakirti was a layperson, just like us. He was not a lifelong celibate monastic. He lived in the world. He had a family, and he was engaged in the business of making a livelihood and everyday living, just like us. Even those of us who are ordained as Zen priests, in our tradition, we're not lifelong celibate monastics. We may have families, we may have jobs. And my feeling is that's really what the world needs now, is people who are, you know, have a strong commitment to living a conscious life, being aware and awake in the world. So that's us. We're apprentice bodhisattvas, right? And the second point is Vimalakirti was a master of upaya. That's a Sanskrit word that's often translated as skillful means or expedient means. Using just the right way of teaching or supporting a particular being in suffering. But somehow neither of those words, skillful or expedient, seems quite adequate to me. I've never really liked the them as translations for upaya. Because one can be quite skillful and quite expedient for completely self-serving ends, right? Happens all the time, either blatantly or subtly. Even, you know, some of it's pretty subtle. So to me, we have to say that upaya is the capacity to respond to particular circumstances with the right combination of wisdom, compassion, and discernment. That's to me what upaya is. And yeah, skill, because we do learn. We can learn. How to choose the right tool for the right job. Right? Have you ever tried to use the wrong tool for Yes. It's an exercise in frustration and ineffectiveness. And sometimes that's what you have to do, though. Right? Sometimes you don't have the right tool, and you make the best of what you have. And maybe you've had the experience of someone trying to help you using a method that's too blunt or too sharp or too heavy or too light and doesn't quite fit with where you're at. You know that feeling? So I love the image of the thousand armed Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, each of those thousand hands holding a different tool. But also, sometimes the best response is to refrain from intervention, right? And just be fully present, with an open heart and a listening ear. So as Michael mentioned yesterday, Vimalakirti went anywhere and everywhere, meeting people in gambling halls, on the streets, in palaces or hovels, using his upaya to help them let go of greed, hate, and delusion. So it's not about fixing people, it's about a way of being that supports people to let go. Let go of grasping, self-focus, and to see the true nature of our being, which is impermanent and boundlessly interconnected. So we do that by how we live and our own deep understanding. And we do it even if our understanding is flawed. We don't have to wait until we are perfectly achieved bodhisattvas. We offer our lives. And even in our mistakes, even in our missteps, we offer them up with a kind of grace that supports others. Surprise! We can even offer up our mistakes. So Vimalakirti even went so far as to allow himself to become gravely ill in order to teach the Buddha's disciples and a host of bodhisattvas about impermanence and the nature of being. And this is the core story of the sutra. So the Buddha hears about Vimalakirti's illness and calls his disciples and asks them to visit Vimalakirti and see how he is. And one after another, each disciple makes an excuse about how, for example, when he was out preaching some aspect of the Dharma to a group of people, Vimalakirti showed up and said essentially, "Oh, you shouldn't say it that way, this is how you should say it." And then leaves the disciple in the dust with his eloquence. So the disciple would say to the Buddha, "Oh, sorry, but Vimalakirti expounded the Dharma and he inspired 800 lay people to practice the way, so I'm not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness." Have we ever used an excuse a little bit like that? Oh, I am not worthy. You know, I'm not confident. Anyway, so the whole host of disciples and bodhisattvas did exactly that. So here's how the very first encounter goes. The setting is a little room in Vimalakirti's house where he lies in his sick bed. And he thinks, I'm lying here sick in bed. Why does the world-honored one, that's the Buddha, in his great compassion fail to show some concern for me? Huh. And the Buddha, through his supernatural powers, is aware of Vimalakirti's thought. And he says to Shariputra, remember Shariputra is the disciple who's renowned for his competence, his deep understanding. The Buddha says, you must go visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. Shariputra replies, world-honored one, I am not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. Why? Because I recall one occasion in the past when I was sitting in quiet meditation under a tree in the forest. At that time, Vimalakirti approached and said to me, ah, Shariputra, you should not assume that this sort of sitting is true quiet sitting. Quiet sitting means not rising out of your samadhi of complete cessation. Complete cessation means complete dropping away of self, you know, all those worries and preoccupations that we have. And yet showing yourself in the ceremonies of daily life, this is quiet sitting. Not abandoning the principles of the way, and yet showing yourself in the activities of a common mortal, this is quiet sitting. Your mind not fixed on internal things and yet not engaged with external things. This is quiet sitting. Unmoved by sundry theories, but practicing the 37 elements of the way, this is quiet sitting. Entering nirvana without having put an end to earthly desires. This is quiet sitting. If you can do this kind of sitting, you will merit the Buddha's seal of approval. Huh. So Shariputra says to the Buddha, when I heard Vimalakirti speak these words, I remained silent, for I had no way to reply to them. That is why I am not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. So, as Michael mentioned yesterday, Shariputra in the Mahayana Sutras is often a little bit of a fall guy. He tries so hard, and yet he can't quite get it. And he's easy for most of us to identify with. I mean, there he is, earnestly sitting zazen under a tree, just like Shakyamuni under the Bodhi tree. Just like he's supposed to. And along comes Vimalakirti, who tells him, don't just sit there, do something. While maintaining samadhi free from self-clinging, calm and quiet, go about the ceremonies and activities of daily life. Don't get stuck on internal or external things. And enter nirvana without putting an end to earthly desire? What does he mean? Shariputra is dumbfounded. He can't reply. No wonder he's too intimidated to visit Vimalakirti. So this is, of course, Vimalakirti's way of teaching, right? What it is to be a bodhisattva in the world. So each of these incidents is kind of a skillful means of the sutra to give Vimalakirti's teaching. And that's just the first of many encounters, and they each come up with a different excuse, a different situation. Vimalakirti Sutra is one of the few Buddhist texts that is actually quite humorous. I really can't think of, well, the Zen koans are, but in the early sutras, there's not too much humor. So after all the disciples refuse to go, the Buddha calls upon an assortment of bodhisattvas who have very extravagant names, like Virtue Guardian, Good Constellation, Lion Will, Lightning God. Who likewise make excuses about how Vimalakirti showed them up. So this Wednesday we'll look at some of these encounters, a few more of these, but right now I want to move on with the plot. After all the bodhisattvas have refused Buddha's request to visit Vimalakirti, he appears to Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, one of the greatest bodhisattvas. And Manjushri reluctantly agrees, even though he too is intimidated by the layman's great dharma power. When word gets out that the great Manjushri and Vimalakirti are gonna meet, a huge crowd assembles. all the bodhisattvas and the major disciples, the Brahmas, the Indras, the four heavenly kings, all think to themselves, now these two great men, Manjushri and Vimalakirti, will be talking together and they will surely expound the wonderful Dharma. So at that time, 8,000 bodhisattvas, 500 voice hearers, and hundreds and thousands of heavenly beings all decide at once that they would like to accompany Manjushri on his visit. Can you imagine being in the hospital? Could we just put a limit on this? But Vimalakirti just invites them all in. And Manjushri asks Vimalakirti how he's doing. And he says, layman, this illness of yours, can you endure it? Is the treatment perhaps not making it worse rather than better? The world-honored one countless times has made solicitous inquiries concerning you. Layman, what is the cause of this illness? Has it been with you long? And how can it be cured? This is exactly the way we typically interrogate a friend who is sick or in the hospital. We ask for details about the diagnosis and the treatment. And maybe we offer some helpful naturopathic possibilities. We might even subtly imply that they brought this misfortune on themselves, you know. They might have been more careful about their diet or their exercise. Have you ever, you know, been in that situation of people, of being the one who's ill? Yeah. But Vimalakirti answers quite differently from the average person's account of their symptoms and treatments. Here's what Vimalakirti says. This illness of mine is born of ignorance and feelings of attachment. Because all living beings are sick, therefore I am sick. If all living beings are relieved of sickness, then my sickness will be mended. Why? Because the bodhisattva, for the sake of living beings, enters the realm of birth and death. And because he is in the realm of birth and death, he suffers illness. If living beings can gain release from illness, then the bodhisattva will no longer be ill. It is like the case of rich parents who have only one child. If the child falls ill, then the father and mother too will be ill. But if the child's illness is cured, the father and mother too will be cured. The bodhisattva is like this. Bodhisattvas are like this, for they love living beings as though they were their own children. If living beings are sick, the bodhisattva will be sick. But if living beings are cured, the bodhisattva too will be cured. You ask what cause this illness arises from. The illness of the bodhisattva arises from their great compassion. When I first read this passage, it kind of blew me away. And it reminded me of an interview I read years ago. It was an interview with a Catholic nun who worked with people with HIV and AIDS in the early years of the epidemic, when there was so much fear and ignorance and stigma around the illness. And the interviewer asked this nun, if Christ was alive today, how would he respond to AIDS? And she answered, Christ would have AIDS. His embracing of the illness would be a bodhisattva's gift of no fear. It's one of the greatest gifts, the gift of no fear. If we are to walk the path of the bodhisattva living in this world where there's so much suffering, in a way that does no harm and is a benefit to others, we will feel the suffering of beings. And we will sometimes weep the tears of a bodhisattva. Because we are embodied human beings, we will encounter the challenges of sickness, old age, and death, and we'll do our best to meet those challenges with wisdom and compassion, a measure of grace and good humor, if we can, so that our way of living will be a teaching. As some of you know, many of you know, Michael and I just returned from a trip out to the Maritime Provinces, to New Brunswick, where there was a gathering of people I knew a long time ago, in the early 1970s. Last year marked 50 years since I and several others of the group immigrated to Canada. It was during the later years of the Vietnam War. And some of us were refusing to contribute to that brutal racist war. And we were young. We were looking for a way to live simply and ethically, and take responsibility for our basic needs. Many of us bought rundown old farms along the Bay of Fundy, where we learned how to grow and harvest and preserve our own food, cut and split firewood, build and repair our dwellings. We valued what was called being self-sufficient. Our self-sufficiency was challenged profoundly when our friend's beautiful 3-year-old daughter was hit by a truck and killed when playing at a neighbor's house. And in the ensuing panic, the neighbors took our friends, put them on a plane to the airport, and where they flew back to their families in Vermont. And we did not see them for another 6 months till they came back in the fall. And we all gathered at their beautiful little homestead, and we walked across the meadow, and we scattered this small box of ashes beneath a massive old sugar maple tree. And then we walked back to the house, and we had a potluck, a quiet potluck, because that's all we knew how to do. And this was a really kind of revelatory moment for me to realize that we had no elders, we had no traditions, we had no songs, we had no prayers for all our skills, our back-to-the-land skills. We had no tools with which to hold our friends and ourselves in this experience. And so they left. They never lived there again. They had another daughter, but their relationship would end soon after. The first day after we all gathered, just a couple weeks ago, not even, in New Brunswick, a number of us went for a walk to some beautiful, quiet beaches completely off the tourist trail track along the Bay of Fundy. And my friend, the woman whose daughter died, that turned to drove with me and another woman, and she said she wanted to let us know that this was the 48th anniversary of her daughter's death, and that she wished for us to do something at the beach. So what we did was, it was just simple, but we made a cairn. You know what a cairn is? It's a pile of stones to mark as a memorial, or a top of a mountain, or a landmark, a wayfinding sign. So we all gathered, and these are the most beautiful pebbles out there. Very beautiful stones, shapes and colors. So we made a cairn, a very beautiful cairn. And then I had some water in my thermos. Michael and I had gone to Cape Breton Island, and we were lucky to be there for a full moon water blessing ceremony with a Mi'kmaq elder, and by the riverside. So I sprinkled some of this water on the cairn. And we mostly were just in silence, But it was more than we could have done all those years before. And my friend said that it had taken her decades to realize that her daughter's death wasn't just something that happened to her, that to her and her husband, but to many others. It had changed all our lives. And there we were, 50 years older. Some were losing their eyesight, some were limping, you know. A lot of gray hair, a lot of thin hair. Some had arthritis. Some were pretty fit still. 50 years later. A bodhisattva knows deeply that when what happens to one happens to all. Vimalakirti's message is that the suffering we meet in our lives is what opens our hearts to others. So let's go back to the sutra. Manjushri questions Vimalakirti further about his illness. Manjushri asks, "This illness of yours, layman, what form does it take?" And Vimalakirti says, "My illness has no form, it cannot be seen." So Manjushri asks, "Is this illness seated in the body or in the mind?" And Vimalakirti says, "It is not seated in the body, for it is apart from bodily form. And it is not seated in the mind, for the mind is a phantom-like thing." In other words, you can't pin this down. Body and mind, you can't separate it out. And Manjushri asks, "Of the four major elements, earth, water, fire, and wind, to which of these elements does this illness pertain?" And Vimalakirti says, "This illness does not pertain to the element earth, but neither is it separated from the element earth. And the same may be said of the elements water, fire, and wind. Yet the illnesses of living beings arise from the four elements." So this is full of paradox, isn't it? Full of paradox. We are beings made up of these elements, made up of this earth, and yet, it is all in flux. And again, he says, "Because living beings have these illnesses, therefore I too am ill." So his illness, like our suffering, is not just a physical illness, though we experience it in our bodies. Right? Our illness is the human condition itself. It's living in a body subject to sickness, old age, and death, and it's how we react to that reality. It's fear, anger, loneliness, grief, craving, all the afflictive emotions we are subject to in a body-mind conditioned by countless generations of human karma. It's always wanting our human condition to be otherwise than it is right now. The Buddha was known as a great physician. And what he offers is a kind of a medicine kit, toolkit. Medicine kit, a scaffolding I like to think of as practice for how to live in this world. And not turning away from suffering is imperative if we are to see deeply into its nature. I think many of you have heard of Joanna Macy, who is a pioneer of engaged Buddhist practice, decades-long peace and environmental activist and teacher of what she used to call despair and empowerment work. And now she calls it the work that reconnects. I think she's well into her 90s now. I meant to look. I think of her as a contemporary Vimalakirti. because she's sharing this work widely beyond, not just, you know, to Buddhist circles. And a core tenet of her work is that we must honor our pain for the world if we are to summon the energy and commitment to respond with upaya, wise and compassionate means, to the many kinds of suffering in our world today. You don't need me to list them for you. Joanna Macy says, the term honoring implies a respectful welcoming, where we recognize the value of something. Our pain for the world not only alerts us to danger, but also reveals our profound caring. And this caring derives from our interconnectedness with all life. We need not fear it. So when she says honoring our pain is honoring our caring, honoring the depth of our caring and our connectedness. And from this place of connection, then we can expand our view to include a wider sense of self, a different way of experiencing and using power in this world, a richer sense of community, and a deeper sense of time. These are all things that she talks about in this book. I'd recommend any of her books. This one she wrote with someone named Chris Johnston. And it's called Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. Oh. In a couple of weeks, we're going to have a day-long workshop on her work here, where we can do some of her practices together. But I'm also going to maybe sprinkle in a few along the way through these 8 weeks of our practice period. But I'd like to share a story with you that she offers in this book. It's about Parsifal, who was one of the great knights in the days of King Arthur. And there are many, many versions of this story, and I'm just going to... Oops. This is her adaptation. I'm going to adapt it a little too. That's how stories, old stories work. So Parsifal was on a quest, of course, as the knights used to be. He was riding for days through a strange land, just devastated, a wasteland. Nothing grew. Maybe there'd been fires. Maybe there'd been floods. He was searching for food and shelter, and he came to a lake where two people were in a boat. And one of them was dressed in kingly garb. And this was the legendary Fisher King. There are stories about the Fisher King. There was a movie. Does anybody remember Robin Williams? Yeah. As a homeless person. Fisher King, yeah. So this is the Fisher King. And Parsifal asked where he could find lodging, and the king gave him directions to get to his castle. When Parsifal got to the castle, he was welcomed in, and there was the king laid out in his bed, terribly wounded. And it turned out that the king was a victim of a spell that stopped his wound from healing and stopped his lands from regenerating. So that's why the land was so devastated. But as the evening went on, nobody talked about it. Nobody mentioned it. And so Parsifal, of course, didn't know. But Parsifal, like many of us, was raised to not ask questions. You know, like it's intrusive if you ask someone what's wrong. That's how I was raised. You know, you don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to stir things up. So he never asked. And he just went his way. Even though he felt the king's terrible pain. And it was just, you know, it distressed him to see this ruined land. And we woke up the next morning, they had all disappeared. So he found his way back to King Arthur's court. And there was a celebration to welcome him back. And in the middle of that, an old woman appeared. The kind of old woman who was very wise and was often called a witch. And she said, "You mean to tell me you never asked what was wrong?" And Parsifal was embarrassed. In fact, he got quite depressed. How could I have been so stupid? Right. So he wandered for many years through many more adventures before he finally came to the castle of the Fisher King again. And the Fisher King was in even more pain and agony than before. So Parsifal realized he had to say something. So he went up to the king and knelt before him and said, "My lord, what aileth thee?" And at that, the king was cured and his lands began to regenerate. The spell was broken. It's a pretty good teaching story about the kind of spell that we are under. You know, we are our conditioning, our many kinds of conditioning kind of casts a spell upon us. And yet that's all it is. It's all it is. And we can say, "What's wrong? What's wrong here? What's hurting you?" We can do what Parsifal finally did. Ask, "How are you doing?" And then listen. We can have the courage that Manjushri did to finally go and visit Vimalakirti. Parents who have experienced the death of a child, surely one of the most devastating kinds of loss there is, have told me that people they thought were really good friends would cross the street to avoid meeting them in their grief. Like literally pass by without looking because it was too frightening to face the intensity of that grief. I remember a woman I knew when I worked for Burnaby Hospice, whose young adult son had died in a freak accident, telling me that when she sat every day immobilized by grief, not even wanting to live, there was a friend, not even a close friend, but a man who came every morning and just sat with her and brought her a banana. And sat there, and she actually was willing to eat the banana. He didn't quiz her or say, "What can I do? What can I do?" They just sat. And she said that meant the world to her. She said that might have saved my life. Those bananas might have saved my life. And I remember back in 1990, a long time ago now, I spent 5 months in Japan when my sister was ill and through her illness and dying in Japan. And when I came back, you know, everything was the same here, but everything was altered in me. And not a single person asked, "How was that for you?" They asked how my parents were, but then not a single person, yeah. Maybe some of you have read the book, it's been out for many years now, called Autobiography of a Face by Lucy Greeley. Anybody remember that book? Lucy Greeley in childhood contracted a very aggressive cancer, facial cancer of the jaw, I think it was. And she had numerous disfiguring surgeries and plastic surgeries, reparative surgeries. She wrote that the pain as a young woman of being rendered hideous was more painful than any of the physical pain that she experienced. And no one, not the medical professionals, not her parents or relatives, ever asked her how she felt about all that. Isn't that stunning? Maybe it was just the overwhelming to them to face the pain of this disfigured child, right? What can you say? They turned away. The Irish writer Sinead Gleason, in this book called Constellations, remembers Greeley's experience. That's what reminded me. I read the book years ago. Is her remembering that book. And her book is about her own lifetime of living with pain from a rare arthritic condition and numerous surgeries, and through a bout of leukemia and two pregnancies and births. So intimate with pain. She writes in a piece that mixes poetry and prose called Where Does It Hurt? Based on the McGill Pain Index, where patients are given all these different words to describe pain, like dull, sore, tender, taut, aching, suffocating, grueling, punishing. So she sort of spins this out in all these different words. And she says, it is difficult to explain a specific pain to someone who has never experienced it, or to someone whose life has been largely devoid of pain. Medical practitioners created this list and chose the descriptors. The words do not come from the person experiencing the pain. The words belong to the doctor, not the sufferer. This is an attempt at reclamation. So that's how she works with these words. And then later, she says, I have been condescended to by enough doctors to know when I'm not believed. When I try to use words like the ones on this list to articulate and communicate physical distress, sometimes I cannot find the word, or know there may not be one. Patients fight for their health to be acknowledged, to be treated, for someone to say, I know what this is and I will help you, or I will add, to acknowledge, I don't know what this is and I will keep trying to figure it out with you. Pain is about answering a question the body asks. It is shared to find a solution, but often met with doubt. Is it really that bad? Maybe some of us have had experiences like that of being doubted, and not just with physical pain, with any kind of inner pain. There's that risk in sharing that it won't be believed or will be diminished or dismissed. Yeah. And so sometimes it's necessary to use other means than words to express pain and suffering. Sometimes we have to paint it or sculpt it or sing it or dance it. These narratives, these eloquent narratives by women, I read these, this kind of writing sometimes, and I think it's not that kind of, you know, TV movie, the kind of slightly smug, whew, I'm glad that's, you know, at least my life's not that bad, kind of reaction. It's more like I feel these writers and artists are kind of like Vimalakirti. They're teaching us. They're teaching us through their experience. So that we can open our hearts and so that we can touch our own experience authentically. And we may experience others turning away. When we express our pain for the earth, you know, sometimes our friends or relatives may say, oh, I don't need all that doom and gloom. Right? And so again, sometimes we need more than words to express that too. But however we express our pain or our suffering, we need to attend to it and be attended to. And no one can really know the pain of another or the experience of another. Most of us can't know how a child in wartime feels in Ukraine or in Yemen, or how a mother or father feels unable to protect a child, a starving child or an injured child in wartime. But we've all been children, right? We've all had a parent or been a parent. And compassion is necessarily an act of imagination. It can't be other, right, than an act of imagination, an act of how does this person feel? Of resonance. We have that capacity. We learn, we develop that capacity as little children, right? To resonate with others, to read others. And sometimes we don't, you know, our development of that capacity isn't fully developed because of circumstances of our childhood. And the good news is we can still develop it. And this practice really helps us, I think. It's not easy, we have to practice. We need to be able to ask ourselves and each other, what concerns you about our world today? What is heavy on your heart? And then listen. Bearing witness is one of our most important bodhisattva practices. The next passage in the sutra is one I find deeply moving and comforting and encouraging, because the life of a bodhisattva is a path, not a destination. And even an experienced bodhisattva can sometimes become weary and discouraged, assailed by doubt and heartache. Who of us has not felt discouraged and weary at some point in the past? In these recent years. So Manjushri asked Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva comfort and instruct another bodhisattva who is ill? Isn't that a great question? Okay, so you're going to have to wait till next week to hear what Vimalakirti says. You can read ahead, you know. I hope you're getting to like Vimalakirti as much as we do. So thank you all. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for practicing together and for coming on Zoom. Let's chant together. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to save them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable, I vow to become it.